Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us today. I think it's a small enough room, and my voice is loud enough. I'll forgo the mic. Just as a reminder, thanks, appreciate it. As a reminder, please silence your phones. You know, it's funny how often after you hear that, I still hear somebody's phone go off during the session. So I give everybody permission to point and stare at the person whose phone does go off if that happens. Session is being recorded, so if you do have questions, speak loudly or into the mic so that we can have that. And the recordings will be available for purchase after the symposium. So consider purchasing either audio or also some of the books that they have for sale. The session is 90 minutes long, and we ask the audience and presenters to keep within that framework so that we can allow the next session to start in time as well. So about this presentation, during a one-year volunteer position with Thrive Gulu, an NGO with a mission of healing trauma in victims of the 20-plus year war in northern Uganda. It's Elder Cunningham, right? Is that where he served? Book of Mormon musical? Okay, sorry.
Oh, damn.
Sorry, I didn't want to.
Uganda.
This presenter lived among three cultures, the LDS culture, the Western mental health culture, and the Akoli culture. Did I say that right? Even close?
Atoli.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The interplay, clashes, connections, and confusions among these three cultures highlight the challenge of preserving core values in a diverse context. Marie Blanchard has a Doctor of Mental Health degree from the University of California, San Francisco, and has practiced as a licensed clinical psychologist in Fremont, California since 1982. She loves traveling both in developing countries and with her clients in their personal interior journeys. And the time over to you.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming and for my loyal supporters. And I'd like to introduce Linda Taylor, who is a board member of Thrive Gulu, and I think has been from the beginning of its inception, right? Right. Yeah. And my loyal family members and friends. To begin, this is Africa. I'll begin with a little experience of mine. I don't know if it's harder to read with or without the glasses. I was traveling to Kampala, which, for those of you who don't know, is the capital of Uganda, to deal with some visa problems. And I was told that the safest and the newest buses were with Homeland Bus Line. It was a six-hour trip, so I settled into the very front left seat. And we traveled about 2 hours, and then something made me glance over to the right, and I noticed that the bus driver was holding the steering wheel in one hand and holding the windshield to keep it from falling over on him with the other hand. So, well, it'll come in a minute because I don't have that one. Maybe I do. Yeah. Anyway, this is him taking it out of the frame. He, holding it that way, moved over to the left side of the road. They drive on the left here and slowed the bus and stopped, and then he lifted the thing out and dropped it down and then took up the mic and told us all to get off the bus. So we figured, well, another bus would be coming. There we go. Well, about 20 minutes later, he told us all to get on the bus, and then he got on the bus too. There's no windshield there. I handed him my sunglasses so that the next 4 hours that we were driving, he wouldn't get dust in his eyes because we would be going about 70 k an hour. And so 4 hours later, we got to Kampala. And the young men there at the bus station were all laughing at him, saying, ha, 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 you think you're driving a motorcycle, don't you? But this is Africa. Yes. Yeah, okay. So the title of the presentation, as you know, is The Witch Doctor in the Sky. So I'll tell you another little story where this came from. Our women's therapy group was meeting, and the topic of the discussion was something that women don't really talk about unless they know each other really well. This is the problem of the other woman. Rose, in her individual sessions, had expressed shame and sadness about her husband's other woman, whom she'd never met, but with whom she'd found out through gossip, had two more children. Group members offered sympathy and suggestions, and finally Rose said, "Well, what I'm doing is that every time my husband doesn't come home, well, of course, I know he's at her place, then I pray to the witch doctor in the sky that he won't be able to perform," which made the other women laugh. But then Irene said, "But have you tried a real witch doctor?" To these women, the witch doctor's power is real, and they don't necessarily consider it evil. The power of a witch doctor is to witch, to bewitch. And the charms and spells work in real time, not heavenly time. You don't have to wait. Of course, if it doesn't work, you just pay more or go to another witch doctor. So I returned to the U.S. last March after the one-year volunteer stint with Thrive Guru. And as I was introduced, it deals with the victims of that 20-year-plus long war with the Lord's Resistance Army, known as the LRA, and the government troops, known as the National Resistance Army. And my mandate was to build a mental health program and to train staff counselors to work with mental disorders other than PTSD and depression, which were already being treated there in Gulu quite with some degree of success, although you never get rid of depression in a population that is living on the edge of poverty and has so much trouble in their past. I'm a mental health professional, so I know that field well through training and experience, but the challenges of mingling the Acholi culture with my Western mental health practices and with modern LDS-correlated organizational practices definitely required new focus and new learning. The challenges that I abstracted from the experiences over the year, or about halfway through the year, because they were falling into these categories, were the lack of a sense of personal power and efficacy on the part of the Acholi people, at least the residents around the Guluk area, witchcraft, polygamy, poverty, and keeping time. But first, Uganda. So, I know what your first association to Uganda is, the Book of Mormon musical. What other associations do people have to Uganda? Yeah?
My granddaughter just got back
from
service for 6 months.
Oh, was she in Kampala?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And how did she like the experience? They're extremely friendly, even though they're very diverse tribally. Of course, Mzungus, we hold a position where we were the masters at one time, so people are still a little deferential. What? Idi Amin, the butcher of Uganda, yes. Anybody else? Yes? It's all over Uganda, in fact, all over most of Africa, actually. Yes, anybody think of poisonous snakes like the Gabon viper or the gorillas that are down in southwestern mountain gorillas? How about Joseph Kony? Anybody heard that name, Joseph Kony? Yes, he's the author of a lot of the troubles there in the northern Uganda right now. As you probably know, Uganda is a collection of different tribes that were administered during the colonial period by the British. Buganda was the name of the most advanced and favored tribe under the British. A nod in passing was given to the 29 other tribes and language groups by dropping the B from Buganda and leaving the U for unification when independence was obtained in 62. Thus, the nation of Uganda was created. Some background. There are two major linguistic groups in Uganda. The Bantu, who originated in West Africa and moved south and east as far as what is now South Africa between 3000 BC and 1400 AD. And you may ask why this is important. Well, wars are still going on because of the clashes between the two linguistic groups. The Buganda tribe is Bantu in language structure, and that was part of the reason they were favored. They were thought to be smarter than the other groups. The other main group is Nilotic, the original inhabitants of the Nile Valley and surrounding country. The people I worked with in northeastern Uganda are Nilotic, and more specifically, Acholi. In Uganda, English is spoken as a lingua franca among the 40 tribes. In Acholi land, a few speak it very well. Some who have been to school get by a little bit, and the rest speak none. Although they may know the word Coke, Coca-Cola. Here he is, Idi Amin. He was the president of Uganda during the 1970s and was from the Kakwa tribe in the northwest. As a military commander in the 70s, he began, even then, massacring Acholi people. He would go to the military outposts and barracks and just kill them all with his troops. Though Amin was from the north, his tribe was Muslim, and the Acholi in the northeast are Christian. When he became president, he systematically set about eliminating any perceived enemies. People my age may remember that he expelled all the Indians from the country, giving them only 2 weeks to leave. The Indians were the merchants, and with the whole mercantile class gone, much of the economic system crumbled, and it took a while for it to restore itself. A conservative estimate for the number of people Idi Amin killed during the first 2 years of his presidency is at least 80 to 90,000. And it could, some estimates range up to 1 million during the whole course of his butchering. Well, this is Africa. People are fond of saying, my coworkers would say whenever I'd ask them about something that didn't seem to make sense, well, this is Africa. Their hands would go like that. The current president is Yoweri Museveni. He's in the 30th year of his presidency. He's targeted the Acholi people since he was general of the National Resistance Army, the army that fought the Lord's Resistance Army in Acholi land. Gula region doesn't have the intense, green, beautiful vegetation of the south. It's savanna and much drier. The border with South Sudan is only about 70 miles away, and refugees from the current war there are flooding into Uganda, stressing resources to the max. And these people are very poor, so that having people come from South Sudan with nothing is really, really difficult for everyone. Gulu is less than one generation away from that horrible war between the two armies. The Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, was led by an Acholi, Joseph Kony, and the National Resistance Army was led by General Museveni, who's now president. And he was from the Banyankole tribe, a Bantu group. Neither group cared for the citizens they mutilated and ruined and killed in the course of the conflict. Kony's army captured about 40,000 children, boys who were big enough to act as porters and soldiers, and girls old enough to act as wives, that is, sex slaves for the commanders. If they hadn't reached menarche yet, they were used as household servants until they menstruated, and then they were given to a commander. The government troops forced citizens to leave their farmland, their means for survival, their identity, since the farmland stays in the family and is almost religiously held. They were herded into camps, the infamous internally displaced persons camps. And this probably sounds familiar because you've read in the news, of course, about Boko Haram during the last few years. They're doing the same thing in northern Nigeria. Well, in Gulu region, a whole generation grew up without education, without sufficient food, with no medical care. That's a whole generation. Government troops raped and pillaged during the nights in the camps outside the city and in the villages during the day. And Kony's troops were active all the time, everywhere but in Gulu City proper. A driver who Al-Kaldé had worked for Thrive and confessed to me during a long road trip that he had supported the LRA and still does, something that you now only admit to a confidant, but you know that, you know, when you're on long road trips, lots of secrets get shared. David had been orphaned when the government troops shot his father. His mother had already died. Thereafter, he had lived on the streets until he was able to get into a driver's training program and thus extricate himself from scavenging. He believes that Kony and Acholi, that Kony's LRA was trying to help the Acholi people, while Museveni, the general of the government army, was bent on destroying them. And so it still seems. There are many, many orphans. There are large numbers of parents who lost children to the LRA abductions. Claire, a colleague of ours at Thrive, she has a different name, but you would know who she is, said one of her two abducted sisters had returned 4 years after being taken. The two sisters had been snatched while they were digging in the garden. The sister who has not come back, no one knows what happened to her, if she's dead or alive. And just about last week when I was going over my notes and this, it suddenly came to me, something I wouldn't have thought on the spot. I wonder if the sister who came back saw her sister killed and murdered just as after they were captured, because that was a practice. It would have been too hard to think of then. The LRA did not give token allegiance to Islam as Boko Haram does. In fact, Joseph Kony sought to restore the Ten Commandments. His followers believed the Holy Spirit spoke through him. To avoid being immediately killed, many of the abducted children were forced on the spot to kill their parents or friends. Afterwards, they were told, "This is your initiation." They were then anointed with shea oil and told, "And now you're a real soldier." The children were also told that they would not be accepted back into their families now that they were killers. And of course, they were terrified and horrified at what they had done. This woman is, it's a picture from the internet. And I saw a woman who'd had this kind of mutilation done to her at Thrive. Of course, I didn't take a picture of her. And this woman has obviously had plastic surgery. You see, the LRA and people like Boko Haram, they cut off the noses, the ears, and the lips as a sign to other people not to mess with them and not to oppose them. So you see this woman, the tip of her nose has been cleaned up. She's had some grafts on her lips and her ears are fixed. But she still looks somewhat like a zombie. Oh, where are we? In the bush, if you didn't do what the leader wanted, you would certainly die or be disfigured. You were tortured by the leader. You were totally dependent on the leader. You believed everything he said. You were told the Holy Spirit spoke through Kony and that he was invulnerable to bullets. You believed he had this period because he made you, yourself, kill someone you loved. You were isolated and cut off from your former family and from society. You began to revere the leader. You love him. We in the West know this psychological change in prisoners is a Stockholm syndrome. Have you heard of that? Yeah. Now, when I ran through this presentation with my daughter, she gives a lot of presentations in her work. She said, "Mom, you've got to change the slide of that disfigured woman. You had us look at that for such a long time. It's just too difficult to do that." So you can look at this photo of one of the literacy group trainings and imagine that several of those people in there, of the older ones, have been through the war, and some of those were child sex slaves and soldiers. Because if I knew as many as I knew, certainly a good percentage of those people had been involved in that way. Judy Jushku, the founder of Thrive, believed that the most important work in Gulu was to heal these victims, these now grown child warriors and sex slaves. She knew they needed to speak their experiences and to be heard and validated. Therefore, she wanted to record their stories. Two women came into the Thrive Center one day. My translator and I were scheduled to record their stories on video, and after obtaining their consent, we began the process. The first woman spoke about being kidnapped as a young adolescent and then spending 3 years in the bush with the army. She had borne the child of a commander. This day, she spoke of many current physical complaints. She was obviously very depressed, leaking those helpless and hopeless vibes that clinicians associate with clinical depression. She told of her long march into the bush, carrying heavy loads, afraid that if she tripped and fell, she would be killed, because others who fell were bludgeoned to death in front of her. She told us of the labor and delivery of her child, during which she could not make a sound, or else she would be beaten. Finally, she escaped with her child and made her way to Gulu. Then her family was contacted. Her parents refused to see her, to have anything to do with her. In their mind, she was evil, tainted forever. They were afraid of her. This woman's life from there on was filled with struggle and many physical disorders and psychic pain. The second woman came in and signed the consent form and told her story. Her attitude was upbeat. She told of horrible experiences, sometimes soberly, sometimes thoughtfully, but without the bitterness or tortured demeanor that characterized the first woman. This woman had been abducted and had gone through the same type of experiences as the first, except she had borne two babies in the bush. One had died in the bush sometime later, and the remaining child escaped with her mother. The major difference between the two women's experiences, the second woman and her surviving bush child had been welcomed back into her family. I'm very surprised that my voice breaks sometimes now. It didn't bother me at all when I was in Gulu, but somehow when you're a clinician, you have that barrier because you can't help people with that. So please excuse me if I leak a bit. Remembering these things. Psychotherapists know that telling one story to a receptive, empathic listener is the most powerful method of changing traumatic memories. Traumatic memories are stored in the brain in an area that fosters intrusive, emotionally disorganizing breakthroughs here on the right side. Fragments of memory experience as if they're happening in the present. The healing process changes these memories into something we call episodic memory, like a story. They're stored in another location in the brain and have strong connections to the prefrontal lobe where information is evaluated and emotions can be inhibited and dampened. Episodic memories are sequential and are placed in proper temporal relationship to other memories. They are then experienced with some emotional distance as happening in the past, as a part of one's personal history, but only a part. This is Joseph Kony, the man behind it all. When he's not in dreadlocks and an army cap, he looks pretty benign, in a still picture, anyway. The war ended in Uganda in 2008, though Kony and his soldiers had already left the area and were then abducting children and making trouble in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I happened on an article in the National Geographic this September before I went to Gulu. It was on the illegal ivory trade in Africa. Guess who is identified as a strong man behind it all? Joseph Kony. Yes, this twisted man is still alive today. There's not a person who is alive during the past 25 years in Acholi land who is not affected by the war. It's been said that the two armies were like two elephants fighting each other. The people were like grass blades under their feet. As some of you may know, Judy Dushku, the founder of Thrive, is one of the small group of women who started Exponent 2 back in the olden days, the early 70s. For those of you who don't know, Exponent 2 is a feminist magazine that deals with issues women. With the same audacity and spirit that she showed in helping launch and sustain Exponent 2, she launched and developed Thrive, the Trauma Healing and Reflection Center, a non-governmental organization or NGO. She wanted to help the women in Gulu, all victims of the war in one way or another, whether or not they had been abducted. With the same audacity and spirit, she continued to work, and her husband joined her, and the organization has been going on since 2011, is it?
Yeah.
I became acquainted with Thrive 2 years ago while I was reading an article in Sunstone. I was traveling back to the San Francisco area on Southwest Airlines from, guess what, Sunstone Symposium here in Salt Lake. That was 2 years ago. And I'd begun to scale back my psychology practice and was deciding what to do next. Reading Laura McBride's article about the Choli women and helping collect their devastating and incredible stories, I immediately felt, this is what I want to do. The decision was quick. I decided right there, probably while we were flying between Elko and Reno. To make a long story short, I sent an email inquiry which contained my experience and qualifications through Exponent 2 to the author of the article, Laura, and she passed it on to the executive director in Boston. Just about the same time, the board of directors had agreed Thrive needed a professional mental health clinician to design and implement a mental health program. The board had been concerned that a professional mental health person would be too expensive. And then about then, my email came through describing my background and my wish to volunteer. So it all felt synchronistic to me. This was early August, 2 years ago, and the next March I arrived in Gulu. Gulu City looks like a small town, but the population is estimated to be 147,000 at least. Most of the residents live in round clay huts thatched with grass. The huts are usually grouped in compounds that contain extended family members. Cooking is done outside. This is downtown Gulu, and Linda will know that road's now paved. Has been about 2.5 years, I think. But it's pockmarked with potholes and eating, the rain eats into the sides. It's pretty bad. Goods are bought in some little markets manned by people selling produce and other small items. The two so-called supermarkets in town sell very little food other than a few canned goods, soda pop, and liquor. Liquor is a big problem in Gulu, but that's another long story. There are few cars, but numerous motorbikes that, when used for transporting passengers for hire, are called botabotas. I think it's because of botabotas. That's my idea. It's a job for young men who have not been educated. Education's iffy here. Even in the public schools, it costs money. Overcrowded classrooms, 70-plus pupils to one teacher. That's the norm. Sometimes it's more. And as you're probably aware, learning takes place from the book and by memorization. Households don't have books other than the Bible, and parents don't seem to read to kids. When my daughter visited Gulu last Christmas, I had her bring children's books for the children of the Thrive staff. None of the books, except one, was ever read that I know of. And then it wasn't read by the parent, it was read by a cousin. The value of a parent reading to a child is just not understood, nor is recreational reading. People read to pass exams at school. So this is the background and setting where I came to volunteer to do my little bit in cleaning up a little bit of the psychological mess left behind by the two warring elephants. In this presentation, I'll describe those cultural practices that, in my opinion, interfered with establishing both the mental health program at Thrive and having an efficient LDS church unit. The health system in Gulu consists of three hospitals, only two of which the ordinary person can access. One of those two is a charity hospital, Lecho, established by Comboni missionaries out of Italy and now run by the Roman Catholic Diocese. It's supported by contributions from Italy. It's dedicated to the poor. It's crowded with patients and their families, but it is clean. The other hospital is a government referral hospital. It's crowded too, and the standard of care is reported to be lower. We established a relationship between Thrive and the psychiatric unit at the referral hospital in order to provide medication for our clients. Because guess what? The Northern Ugandan people have biological vehicles just like we do over here, and they do well with antidepressants and antipsychotics and the regular meds. Our clients, however, had to be cajoled into going. They were terrified of being seen at that, quote, crazy place. But before I came to Gulu, there was no mental health program providing counseling or regular therapy for the disorders other than depression and PTSD. And since there seems to be the same prevalence of these other disorders in Uganda as in the West, our program really was needed. The mental health program we created at Thrive was group-centered. We provided an intake and 3 individual sessions for each person who entered the program and then assigned him or her to a small therapy group, keeping the maximum number of participants at 8. Sometimes we couldn't meet in Thrive's hut because it was already scheduled for something else, so we had to make do in the place most likely to protect confidentiality, outside on the east side of the building. Like that. That's real. Sometimes under a tree if the ants weren't too bad. This is the hut where we tried to conduct most of the therapy in the groups. And by the way, the woman in the back right, on the back right side is Dora Alal Singhal, who is the program director there and most gifted director and really a lovely woman. After about 2 months into the program, we could see that we had a big problem. Many individuals did not complete the 4 sessions required before a group. Attendance at individual sessions was sporadic, definitely not reliable. Therefore, only 3 continuing groups ever got off the ground. Now to Gulu Branch. A truck went in there to do some work and backed into the wall, so that's the rubble from that accident. That's my bicycle I bought, so I didn't have to walk everywhere. So I had got that after 2 months and left it with the branch president when I left. The formal LDS presence in Gulu began around 2008 when the branch was organized, and there are now 2 branches. A lot of baptisms were happening, but attendance at meetings was low. People seemed to be unreliable. For instance, a Relief Society teacher was called because teaching was being done on the basis of, now let's all take turns reading the manual out loud, 1 paragraph per person. You women who go to Relief Society know the drill. The woman accepted this teaching call, but she never again showed up at Relief Society. When I, as first counselor, finally tracked her down, I found she was in a town about 70 kilometers away at her sister's place and would be there several months. She didn't return while I lived in Gulu. A second counselor to the president was called, and like the teacher-to-be, never showed up again at Relief Society. Occasionally, she would show up at sacrament meeting, but then she would disappear. So they never show up for their first meeting, even. The ward clerk, who did serve for a couple of months, disappeared without notice. And though occasionally he was sighted in town, he didn't show up again at church. A ward choir was organized, led by a competent musician. It quickly fizzled out. And so, onto the first factor I abstracted from my experience. As you've seen before, lack of personal power and efficacy, or a sense of personal power and efficacy. One Sunday, I was outside the church, just getting ready to bicycle home, when Sandra, which is not her real name, came out of the small building where the branch president's office is located. I'd recently been called as a counselor in the Relief Society, a position I'd asked for after turning down a call to be president, because I knew it would not work to have a non-Acholi speaker, as well as somebody who's kind of face-blind, be in that position. So I had recommended Sandra as president. Sandra walked directly over to me and said, I want to ask you to help me by paying my children's school fees. One of the difficulties of being a white person in Uganda is that you're always being asked for money. I'm a Mzungu, the word used in Swahili for white person. All Mzungus are fair game. And if one gives money, you're really not helping this person in the long run. So I had decided that I would decline most offers and offer advice on what the person could do to get what he or she needed. Now, on occasion, I would give money, like the paraplegic who found out where I lived and dragged himself to my house and asked for bus money to Kampala for treatment. Well, whether or not that was why he needed it, I gave the money to him. But it's a little different with Sandra. I knew she'd already been given school fees by another member of Thrive board member who had been there, and the American woman had given them the money. I thought you'd been given money for school fees, I said. And Sandra looked a bit uncomfortable. I think she didn't know that I knew about the other woman. Oh, she finally replied, I used it for the sesame crop I planted. That money will be for school fees in the future. Okay. But she'd already previously asked me to sponsor her and her 7 other family members for citizenship in the U.S. And I knew she was the best dressed person in the branch and that she was better off than a lot of the other people. And so I must admit I was a little bit miffed. I declined her request to pay and suggested she take her children out of school for the coming term until she did have the money available. And this way her children would learn about how money works and where it comes from. But she didn't do that, of course. My guess is that she wasn't in that much difficulty because her 4 children kept going to school, 2 to boarding school. Sandra was just one example, and she's a very good woman and a very efficient and competent woman. But if the truth be told, I became very wary of spending any one-to-one time with branch members. While I could say no, it really puts a damper on a relationship to know your value to another is primarily as a conduit for money. Though I could figure I too would be asking for the same thing if I were in the financial position of most people in Gulu. There is a deeply ingrained feeling in this culture that the other is the source. Perhaps this is because when the English colonized Uganda, they definitely were the other, these colonial masters, and they decided who received the goodies. The displaced persons camp experience contributed to this, I need you to give to me mentality. During that generation-long period, people couldn't farm to feed themselves. They were totally dependent living in those camps. The great big other, the United Nations, provided food, and then others decided who would eat and who would not. Corruption was awful. No amount of initiative on the part of a single person could alter the fact that someone else would decide who was fed and who remained hungry. So, what happens to feelings of personal efficacy when a people who had planted and tended and harvested their own gardens and crops for hundreds of years and could usually feed themselves, became totally dependent on a faceless organization? No personal initiative doesn't count for anything when 2 gigantic elephants, back to that, because it's, to me, it so represents what happened. The LRA, the National Army, fighting each other, and the people in Gulu were just trampled over as if they didn't exist. A side note, when the early explorers, Speke and Burton, Stanley, Samuel Baker, came to the area now called Uganda, they noted that the native tribes didn't store much in the way of crops. By the way, this African land up there is very, very fertile. It's near the Rift Valley. And anyway, these explorers found that the culture of intertribal warfare, the looting, the taking of slaves, kept people from developing incentive to store surplus goods. So you work hard, and you create a surplus, and your neighboring tribe right over the hill gets a little greedy and makes a raid and takes it from you. So creating a surplus is not only unwise, it's a danger. The challenge in Gulu, and indeed in much of Africa, is changing the basic belief that help and resources always come from outside and that individual efforts are ultimately futile. This attitude showed itself in our clinical program. Clients came for counseling expecting to get something tangible after a session. NGOs had typically given some food or goods to the war victims who came to them. Now, a pot or a hoe may have been important to someone who's returned from involuntary servitude as a soldier and has nothing at all. But tangible rewards undermine mental health interventions, as you know. However, we eventually came to the conclusion that the promise of feeling better was too intangible for our clients, too far away in the future to carry value to people who have to scrape by day. And so our mental health team compromised our initial decision to not give goods to clients by giving each person who completed the course of therapy a certificate. We also took an hour to have a graduation, which included cake and soda. Now, just cake isn't seen there because people don't have ovens. There are a couple of businesses that have ovens, but that's it. So the certificate, this paper token, and the Mzungu cake seemed to bestow some value on the positive changes that had occurred as a result of the counseling. And there were positive changes. And I am not over there now, so I can't do follow-ups to see how long they last. But they seem that there were some core things that happened as far as self-worth, definitely, and that showed results in how they managed their personal lives, too, including earning money. In the Gulu LDS branch, the neediness showed itself not only in requests for money, but in the disappearances I mentioned after accepting callings. For instance, people were taught about the importance of callings. And in a Choli culture, though, it's rude to say to no to anyone in a higher position. Of course, in the West, we LDS are not supposed to say no to callings either. But our responsibilities here are different, not so much about basic survival all the time. So, well, you might guess there would be problems when the mission president in Kampala withdrew the full-time missionaries from northern Uganda in order to concentrate effort in the Kampala area. He wanted the next temple in Africa to be built in Kampala. Guess what? Nairobi got it right. What happened in Gulu was that to replace the full-time missionaries, three couples in the branch were called as branch missionaries. And then? Well, soon there was no missionary work done at all. The self-reliance committee, the missionary committee, the new branch choir, all fell apart. And these couples couldn't give two evenings a week with children at home and all the work being done by hand and having to, what they call, foot it everywhere. The time is just very, very different there. It's eaten up with survival things. Yes, the people do work hard. These are women pumping water from a well. Villages often had wells that the government would dig, and the different parts of Gulu, districts of Gulu, had wells, and so the women would go pump their water and then carry it home on their heads. Here is a picture of a young girl. Notice what's on her back. She no doubt is babysitting, and she has her little brother there in the background. Now, she'll be carrying that water home, and her brother will help her. But it's during school hours. She's not in school. And this makes me think she's home either because there's no school fees or because there's little children to babysit and her mother doesn't have time to do that. Children are always kept home or often kept home to do housework and to take care of the children because family planning isn't used. Children are a gift from God. And as they say, birth control has side effects. Excuse me, one of the side effects is that no children. So, the women pump and fetch the water. They carry the water home. They do their laundry by hand without even the scrubbing board that my grandma would use. They do heavy digging in the fields with hoes that have long blades, and they cook food from scratch over charcoal burners outside, and sometimes they even make their own charcoal. For men who are lucky enough to have jobs, The pay is exceptionally low. So, along with the attitude that goods come through someone else and not by one's efforts, there's that ingrained tradition that doesn't allow a person to say no to a request from a person in a higher position. Both contribute to problems in maintaining the LDS branch and the mental health program. Not having the power to make and to do fosters the Acholi belief in the supernatural. If you feel you cannot deal with a problem yourself, getting help from a witch doctor seems quite reasonable. There are traditional healers, but the people there call them witch doctors, too. In English, that's what they call them. In fact, it seems as basic to Acholi identity to go to a witch as is a U.S. citizen's belief that we should have justice and good governance. Going back to the anecdote I shared at the beginning of this paper, the comment about the witch doctor in the sky, I gradually came to see that this belief in witchcraft is really deeply ingrained. This is a witch doctor. One woman told of a witching that got rid of a co-wife her husband had brought home. Horror of all horrors, the new woman used my client's dishes. After consulting a witch doctor, a spell and charm were used by my client, and the new woman's cow died. Then this co-wife decided that she really, really did want to go back to her original family, and she did. The witching worked. On a darker note, the national newspaper, the Daily Monitor, out of Kampala, ran a piece about a young male child's body that was found, and it was traced back to a particular witch doctor. Someone had paid that witch doctor to guarantee success in a new business venture. The kidnappers abducted the young boy. They delivered him to the witch doctor, who then paid them. Then he sacrificed the child. This child's life, the sacrifice for success in business. And there's a huge split there in the population, the very poor and the very rich. We know what person is, what side the person who's paying the witch doctor is on. So one day I saw a little girl with pierced ears and I commented to my friend how pretty the child looked. My friend told me that a mother pierces her female child's ears because it's known that witch doctors want an unblemished child. Ear piercing makes this little girl unacceptable for sacrifice. Most people in Acholi land believe that mental illness is a result of bewitching, and that's true in many developing societies, as I'm sure you know. Call it bewitching, possession by evil spirits, or the evil eye, all are attempts to explain phenomena not understood or beyond one's control. I found that at Thrive, a person may come for counseling, but sometimes hedges her bets by going to the witch doctor, too. In our LDS branch, I never heard bewitching condemned. I never heard it mentioned, either. But listen to this story that our Relief Society president told on one of those Sundays when she chose to teach because the person assigned didn't show. Sandra was teaching about the worthiness to partake of the sacrament. The story goes like this. A missionary had problems with chastity, but he hadn't told anyone, either before his mission or after he began serving. He kept the problem to himself and thought no one would ever know. And this is sort of the way that she told the story.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yes. Okay.
Oh, that's so much better.
I keep letting it drop, I know. Sorry. Okay. One Sunday, he and his companion were in sacrament meeting, and the mission president happened to be on the stand. The sacrament bread was passed. The missionary took a piece of bread, brought it to his mouth, and it dropped right out of his hand. Then he picked up another piece of bread, and his fingers opened, and it dropped again. And he looked up, and the mission president was looking directly at him. Then the water was passed, and the missionary picked up the cup, and it spilled. He looked up again,
and the mission president was staring right at him. The discussion that followed the story didn't focus on the missionary's possible feelings of guilt that might have led him to drop the water, or spill the bread and drop the water, whatever. It seemed clear to me that the Relief Society sisters and President Sandra all believed in the supernatural powers of the mission president to control the tokens of the sacrament. That was my impression. That was not said. But certainly, it seemed clear through the discussion that this was the feeling. Just as we all know that our society is far from ideal here in the U.S., we still believe in the ideal, and so the Acholi believe in the power of witchcraft. And not only the Acholi, but a great many different African cultures. And why not? If the charm or curse is effective, you get what you want. And it proves, then, that the magic is effective. And if the charm is ineffective, it means you try again, usually paying more, or you find a more powerful witch doctor. You don't question the very position of the witch doctor or the powers. People who have lived a long time in the society, Mzungus, say, "Do I believe in witches?" Well, not really. But sometimes you see things and you wonder. The belief here has a parallel in the belief that Mzungu, the white person, will provide material support. The white man is the other. The power of witches is in the other. Remember, there's little faith that individual initiative can produce desired effects. And in such a tightly constructed society, boundaries are culturally placed on individual initiative. So the individual pays the witch doctor for the change he desires. Polygamy. In Uganda, polygamy is not legal. It is not only legal. Yes, it is definitely legal. But it's been the way of life forever. Traditional marriage, the only legal marriage in Uganda, is a long, drawn-out contractual process between the suitor and the prospective bride's father. No church wedding, LDS, or otherwise can legally occur unless this traditional marriage process, including the bride price, is completed. The suitor has to pay a bride price to his father-in-law-to-be, and it's not the same as, a bride price isn't the same as a dowry. A dowry is paid by a young woman's family to the family of the husband-to-be, and like in India. They don't have dowries in Uganda, but unless it's in the Indian ethnic group. The Indians have returned, and they are the again, since the Idi Amin is gone, and they are again the merchants. The bride price is a widespread African practice and is paid by the young man to the young woman's father, and is very expensive, including cows and goats, as well as other items the young woman's father demands. Very few people can afford this. And so, while waiting to accumulate enough money, the couple usually just begin living together and having children. It's considered the husband's right, legally married or not, to choose another woman as co-wife. A man's reputation is enhanced by having many children. My translator, Lucy, her father had 3 wives and 27 children, just like the old days in Mormonism, I guess. Years ago, it provided social security for one's old age. But now it seems really scary to me, not secure because the population is growing at such an unsustainable rate. The children last past the age of 5 in much greater numbers than they used to. Sometimes these added wives live in the same compound and sometimes somewhere else. And sometimes the woman doesn't find out about the someone somewhere else until neighbors and friends begin gossiping. And this is how Rose of the Witch Doctor in the Sky comment found out about the someone else that her husband was seeing. As I said earlier, the subject of the other woman was a topic most discussed in our women's groups. No one liked another woman being brought into the immediate family. The first wife's consent isn't even nominally required. Complaining to the husband doesn't work. Besides, the culture says women need to be married. Unmarried women are looked upon with scorn by men and women alike. If a woman doesn't produce children, other women say, "She can't drop anything but what she drops in the pit toilet." this was told to me by Lucy also. No one I encountered in my year in Uganda ever questioned the practice of polygamy. The only place it's not practiced that I know of is in the LDS church, where, as you all know, a man can't be baptized who has more than one living wife. I guess that's not true, because, well, it wouldn't be your wife if you divorced him here, would it? A driver I hired once for a trip explained to me, when I asked him if his wife wanted as many children as he said that he did, which was 10, I don't know what she wants, he replied. If she ever complains about the number of children I want, I'll just tell her that I'll go to someone else to get them. He was calm. He wasn't snide, although I'm sounding a little snide when I say this. He was just very calm, explaining to me how it was. There was absolutely no recognition that the woman might have a say in the number of children she would bear, she would nurse, she would raise, she would carry on her back to carry water. So women work hard, usually bear as many children as possible, and express their unhappiness about marital circumstances by passive aggressiveness or quiet resistance. And this was the topic, the other woman, that was talked about most in our women's groups and in some form or other in the individual sessions. Shortly before my year at Thrive was up and clients knew I was going back home, a woman we'll call Myrna came into Thrive and asked to see me immediately. As we made our way to the therapy hut, she began to cry. Please, please take me to America with you when you go. Please, please. I'll leave the children with my husband. They won't come with me. They belong to him anyway. And she was sobbing. And children do belong to the husband, legally, not to the wife. When I began to talk with her, she pointed out the marks on her neck, bruises I hadn't noticed before because of her dark skin. She had asked him about the woman who was calling him on his cell phone the night before. A fight ensued, and he tried to strangle her. Here in the U.S., the woman might or might not have gone to the police. Not in Uganda, for though spousal abuse is technically illegal, it's useless to report because the case is never prosecuted. If a lawyer were to be involved, there would be retaliation against him. He would definitely not find work again. And then there's this hut-burning thing. It happens in the night when people inside the hut are asleep. The thatch burns quickly and brightly in the night, and there's only one exit in the hut. There were hut burnings while I lived in Gulu. By the way, the major topic of the men's therapy group was making enough money to feed their own children and the string of relatives who were living with them. Men's stressors are different. Not one man ever mentioned problems with being polygamous. And then there's poverty. As you're well aware, poverty isn't exclusive to Uganda, but the level there is just unimaginable to someone who has only lived in the West. Listen to what Beatrice, a branch member, said when she was questioned by the Relief Society president as to why she didn't show up to meetings regularly. I can't come to church on the days when there's no food in the house. When I have nothing to feed my children, I go to the market instead and try to sell something so there'll be dinner on the table at night and porridge in the morning. I personally knew this to be an accurate description of her circumstance. She was abandoned by her children's fathers, I should say, because the children had two fathers. She was a victim of two recent break-ins and sexual assaults in her hut. She has a chronic disease, and she scrapes by through buying corn flour, repackaging it and reselling it in smaller bags at the market. The northern Uganda tribes have a particular stumbling block to raising their standard of living. Ever since the pre-colonial days, the northerners, the Nilotic peoples, have been considered unsophisticated, uncultured, and fit only for physical work like farming and soldiering. Therefore, after the English came and development possibilities opened, those projects were directed to the southern areas, the Bantu areas. Manufacturing, international trade, finance, infrastructure, all were claimed by the south. Income for northerners stayed extremely low, low enough that it was usually impossible to accumulate any excess. A 2013 report listed rural Ugandans as making the equivalent of $83 per month per family. It's about $800 per year. Even when Idi Amin was president, and he was a northerner by birth, he did not direct projects to his area of origin. Instead, he brought chosen individuals from his tribe to the south, where they stayed, becoming prosperous in and around Kampala. The Nilotic people did not benefit. And if, by intelligence and luck, someone did accumulate a surplus, it would disappear into the clan or through someone's graft. Poverty, individual efficacy, cultural practices all combine to block individual and group progress. In our LDS branch, I was asked to train five young women who had been called by the branch president to learn to play our electronic keyboard. He didn't realize that hardly anyone can learn to play without an instrument on which to practice, and that most homes don't have the electricity, let alone a keyboard. Only two of the girls ever came to a scheduled lesson anyway. A young woman, Gertrude, was scheduled for a lesson, but I waited 2 hours, and then I gave up and started home. I met her as I was walking down the street, and she was really surprised. She had assumed that I would still be at the church waiting for her. This scenario I found was ingrained in Acholi culture. If you're in charge of an event, you wait until people trickle in, sometimes hours later. You don't begin until most of the people are there. If you're waiting for a doctor, you plan on waiting hours. No one plans for a specific time. Most people don't even have watches, and they may have cell phones, but that doesn't mean they work. And I expect this is true in many, many developing countries in the agrarian societies. Waiting on the part of the provider of the service and by the recipient is taken for granted. And therefore, people would show up 3 or 4 hours after their session had been scheduled and be very surprised that I would be with somebody else. Or there even one person showed in a week later at the same time. And it wasn't that she got the time wrong. It's just the way it happens there. Yes, this is Africa. Regarding keeping time, I learned that if your mother comes to visit you, you don't come to session. Family matters take precedence, and making money takes precedence. If your digging group decides to hire out to a farmer on the day of your counseling session, you go with your digging group. So would I if I were that poor. You definitely don't call to cancel, though, because that would be considered rude. That is, if your phone were working, you might consider calling if you weren't a trolley. Back to our mental health program. We realized that our total client numbers were dropping. They weren't just fluctuating. We had to find out why. Now, Thrive has large women's groups for teaching finance, literacy, and joint savings. The clients for our mental health program were drawn from these larger groups. And I asked Peter, who worked with the finance group, to go to those near the center and ask them what they thought the reasons were that more clients weren't signing up for our program. I asked him to do this because I wanted to get a real answer. In Acholi land, it wouldn't have been polite for anyone to tell me directly what was wrong. The factors can be grouped into these four categories. First, fear. Fear of gossip, fear of being seen at the center, fear of stigma, fear of being ostracized because of it. Two, lack of a material reward. Excuse me, they call this carelessness, meaning that the therapist doesn't care enough about you to give you something for coming to the session. As they said, the counselors don't care because they will talk with me, but they won't give me a reward. Careless. Three, time wasting. Counseling does not show its value in immediate income. If I don't go to my session today, I can spend 2 more hours selling in the market and make more money. Relief. Quite a few women said they didn't return after the beginning session because they were already experiencing significant relief. Expressing themselves during that hour and being understood had caused them to feel substantially better. Psychotherapists know this process is one of the major ingredients of therapeutic success. That is, expressing oneself and being understood. It opens the client's mind to new possibilities and it gets them unstuck. I'll insert a question here. What would you do if you're the Brad's president and you have the problems described earlier of people disappearing when they're called to positions? What would you do with the distraught client whose husband comes home with the woman he says is his wife and that she'll live with the family? What do you do if you're LDS, if you want to go to the temple to be sealed to your fiancé? You want to marry but cannot afford the bride price. It will take you years to accumulate the goods and money. You also are taught to believe in the law of chastity. You want to be chaste. You want to marry legally so you can go to the temple. You cannot pay the bride price and therefore can't have a legal marriage, which means you can't be sealed in the temple. What do you do? So, since I believe the factors I've been talking about cause problems in the success of our mental health program and in the Guru LDS branch, what can be done? People foot it everywhere. Most people don't even have a bicycle. Time for a trolley also means it takes a lot of time to go anywhere because one has to walk. A couple of miles to church, 2 or 3, 4 miles to the center for a counseling session, this factor doesn't contribute to regular attendance at either. How could the time spent in getting to the center or church be lessened? And I'm asking these questions. I'm hoping that we'll have a little time in the discussion system where you could section where you can give me your thoughts about that. We can do a little brainstorming. Not that we can cure the problem, but it helps to have many brains thinking about it. Traditionally, a Choli mental health system relies on a witch doctor. Yes, people are hospitalized and put on meds at the government referral hospital, but people hedge their bets by consulting the person who's always treated mental conditions, the witch doctor, as we've said. How can this belief be supplanted, or at least minimized? Something we did do at Thrive when we began to see our new referrals dropping drastically, we decided we could educate the clients, hoping that through understanding, people would come to value mental health intervention and risk being seen coming to the center. This is me and my translator, Lucy. We began by giving presentations on clinical depression to each large Thrive Finance group within walking distance of the center. We taught that depression's a physical problem that is caused by too much stress, that depression kills through suicide, you can die from depression, and that depression can be treated. Though our explanation was simplistic, it's actually true as a generalization. Too much stress causes depression through sequence of hormones, including cortisol. Too much stress hormone roaming around the body over too long a time causes the changes we call depression. And believe me, these women understand stress. We had a poster of a brain inside the head. One counselor, the presenter, that Lucy, would say something in a Choli like, "You've been sick and unable to sell anything at the market for a week." And then she'd point to the drawing of the head. And then she'd say, "And there's no food to feed your children." And I would go, "Bam! Ouch!" The other counselor, me, would do that and make an anguished face. And then on the next thing she'd say something like, "Your husband comes home and tells you he's going to bring another wife into the compound. You will have to share your pots with her." I'd say, "You find out your child has tuberculosis." And so they got the idea. It's like Lucy would say in a Choli, "Stress bruises the brain," which I think is a good way of putting it. It was really effective because we'd have these wonderful discussions after where people would talk openly about their own personal experiences with depression. And everyone knew someone in friend or family who'd committed suicide. Then we described treatment, that is counseling and medication, and we discussed how each type of treatment helped heal the brain. Often during the discussion portion of the presentation, someone would bring up her own problem and talk about it. And then they'd also want to tell their own story of the stress that caused their depression. And this was remarkable because it still is such a stigma about letting anyone else, even if your neighbors know, you don't let them know that you know that they know. The succeeding round of training by Thrive's mental health team has been about suicide. They're doing that now, or we're doing that. They're probably on to something else by now. And as time goes by, other subjects will be taught. But by and by, we hope that a small segment of the guru population will become more comfortable talking about mental health issues. And then some more people will sign up for our counseling program and hopefully be vocal advocates for treatment. With time and teaching, we hope our program numbers will grow and that we'll have more than 3 ongoing groups. And the LDS Church? Well, the organizational model is worldwide. We know it promotes uniformity and helps prevent schisms. But the by-the-handbook procedures provide little flexibility to adjust to local circumstances. Even in Gulu, we were expected to abide by the handbook in every detail. This in a society that's very different from the West. It does make it difficult for many members to remain actively engaged. I do understand the necessity to standardize procedures in this rapidly growing organization. But in my opinion, this standardization, this correlation, acts against the stability of the local congregations. I don't know how to solve this issue, but I do think it is an issue. And I think local flexibility in programming will be worth experimenting with. For instance, why couldn't music involve local instruments at times and favorite non-LDS songs of worship? Why couldn't music involve local instruments at times and favorite non-LDS songs of worship? Could non-service committees be simplified? By the way, George Compton here introduced me to a woman at lunchtime who in a branch here in Salt Lake that they have for victims of traumatic conditions, she plays the piano African style for the services. Could non-service committees be simplified? What could be eliminated or consolidated? Could callings be consolidated? Could teaching and talks be done in the local language? And if English were used, could a translator be employed? Could the talks, those boring talks, include elements the locals can relate to? In our branch, talks were always well prepared and peppered with scriptures, but they seldom included those elements of a Acholi life with which people could relate. And they almost never included a Bible story, which were the stories that these people were raised with. Stories trump quotations, in my opinion. Could worthy LDS members marry in the temple without the legal Ugandan marriage, which demands the bride price? I'm hoping the church will experiment. There will always be tension between organizational stability and program fluidity. The two are paradoxical. But I really believe things need to be loosened up in order for the units to do their jobs in retaining members and healing hearts and broken spirits. Meanwhile, the institution of the church develops and changes, and the gospel of Christ's message is that each person in and out of one's tribe is a loved child of God. And we individuals can try to live Christ's love, trying to recognize each person as valuable, helping where needed. And this conference fits in with my theme, the least of these, because these people are not the least of these, it's only the least of these in material goods. This, my conclusion after 1 year in Gulu, it's not original, but what I just said, I now know in a much deeper way. One cannot expect big changes. Problems are too vast. But one can do little bits, relating to people individually, and facilitate some meaningful differences in single lives. So I'd like to open it up for discussion now and see what thoughts you have about different aspects. So great. The stigma is so great. There were several members I knew of, and so there must have been more, who had AIDS. And many people don't get it through their own will. It's brought home by spouses. About one out of four people has AIDS in Uganda now. And they also went through their own Ebola epidemic 10 years ago that was pretty devastating. And they have a huge seizure problem because children, infants and children, get cerebral malaria and are left brain damaged. And so seizures are one of the biggest mental health problems there are. They call it a mental health problem, but okay. Yes. I think it's an excellent point. And you know, our Relief Society president, she got married while I was there. She had four children and a husband who'd had certain problems, but was coming around, so she finally got married. But what do you do? You're converted, and you can't get married legally in Uganda. There's been some flexibility there in having these people come to church and be baptized. Yes, you had a question?
Wondering who was giving the talks that were not speaking to the people, and was it members? Was it Ugandans? Was it Americans that were living there? Like who kind of runs things if you have people that don't come consistently or that receive callings and
they
disappear?
They were the Acholi members. And they were assigned talks, and as I said, they were very well prepared. They were assigned their topics, and they were given literature, and they were full of quotes. They were good, but, excuse me, I don't think they related, even though they made good points.
So they did what they were told.
They did what they were told.
They decided what they were given, uh-huh, in the way that they put it together, mm-hmm, but it was, uh-huh, this is correlated, and this is what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Linda? Dealt with what they brought in. We didn't do the actual trauma work, because we referred those to VIVO. They have a special therapy program there called pet therapy. Where you tell your story and put it in temporal order. And in about 20 sessions, the trauma is significantly reduced. So that's where we would send them. And we did have one of the big Thrive groups is returnees only. And we had many of the men in that group and from that group in our group. And they didn't talk much about their stories that happened in the army. They talked about their trials since. Yes, and a lot of the land has been confiscated, has been taken by other people, so there are all these claims going on through the courts, and there are two NGOs that I know of that are helping them process those claims, because basically they're in the IDP camps, and their land just disappeared. Other people. And there are through the National Monitor, I found out, they're very clever schemes through computers for changing titles so that the title can't be traced back to the people that it originally belonged to. It's it's an awful, awful society in the sense that the split between those who have and have not, it's not just a split in money and goods, but it's a split in belief in what one has the power and the right to do. Yes, Jim?
That actually leads into my question. I was wondering if you'd ever talked extensively about helping people with mental illness who are in extreme poverty. I was wondering if you ever had any clients who weren't so indigent and what differences there were in them if you did.
Well, probably the least indigent I had was Sandra, who didn't have a lot of money, and she lived in a clay hut. But the other people, I guess maybe they go to the Catholic diocese church. I don't know where they went. I know where they live, but I don't know where they went. They're not in. There was one person with money in our. He was the first branch president, and he does work for UN and international organizations. So he has enough money. He has a car, James, but he goes. You know, and but I doubt that he was very wealthy. I've been in his compound, but he certainly has more money than most people.
Yeah, a question about you mentioned earlier about the sort of African style piano, and I'm curious about the ways in which witchcraft and Mormonism kind of came together in this sort of hybrid.
The only story I really have is that story about the sacrament and the mission president watching. And I, as I said, I didn't spend a lot of time talking to branch members because it was so uncomfortable. And while it made me feel uncomfortable and certainly unloved, I can certainly understand. But what does a person do when you're asked to give the bride price so they can get married? You know, the conflicts there are very, very difficult. So just staying away, I'd go to church and do my job, but that's about it.
You know, just talking about conflicts in culture and how this culture and some of the others have been negatively affected by outside influence, did you ever question whether or not woman, and I have gone on a couple service trips myself to different locations and things, and come away with different ideas, really wondering, am I truly doing good here? Do I have a place here? Am I putting my own cultural norms in a superior place in my mind over there as I'm trying to change things? And am I helping, really?
I didn't have the question so much, am I helping, because I didn't consider that I went over there to help. It was just what I wanted to do. But changing things, I know I wasn't changing things, but I know that some of the relationships we had through therapy and otherwise were changing to both of us, and I think that's true even in professional therapy. When things are working, you're both enriched. And that had to be enough, because I just can't see how things can change. It will have to happen in a way we don't understand, like the Soviet Union falling apart.
Well, that's very close to what I was thinking from my question, because halfway through your trip, I felt myself very frustrated at all of the walls and just difficulties. It kept being thrown in your way, and you know, you have to change your process and your ideas. And, individual connections with people that
Mm-hmm. And I think as far as the program goes, I don't know if it will even continue. At least it won't in the same guise under different leadership and different things. But I've never felt that it wasn't worth doing. And I certainly, it was the only time in my life where I've been for a year and never wondered why I was there. So I think our time's about up. Any more questions or thoughts before you?